This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanison and Noel Lim. 7:06 a.m. Thursday, the 15th of April. And in about 15 minutes, we're going to be speaking with financial columnist Pankaj Kumar on the financing for MRT3. But before that, we are taking a look at the markets.
In the US, the Dow closed up 0.2%. S&P 500 was up 0.4%. NASDAQ closed down by about 1%.
And if we take a look at Asia, a bit of a mixed bag here. Japan's Nikkei 225 was down 0.4%, but both the Shanghai and Hang Seng were in the green. The Shanghai Composite was up 0.6%. Hong Kong's Hang Seng up 1.4%. Closer to the region, Singapore's STI was down 0.3%, and the FBM KLCI eked out in a gain in the green. It was up 0.04%.
Scraped into the green by the skin of its teeth. But for more insight into global markets this morning, we're turning to Tony Nash, CEO of Complete Intelligence. Tony, thanks so much for joining us today. So the IMF has upgraded its GDP forecasts for developed economies, but what is the outlook like for developing economies in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, it's actually not bad. You know, to look at this IMF report, we had such a pullback in economies in 2020. That we really have to look at the growth rates in 2019, 20, and 21 to understand it in context. Southeast Asia looks to be doing pretty well when we average those 3 years out. There's growth in just about every country except Thailand, with a slight pullback over that time. So what that means is Thailand will not necessarily back up to the 2019 levels, unfortunately. But Malaysia, 1.7%, Indonesia, 2.4%, Singapore, 0.38%, those sorts of things. So Southeast Asia is growing. Europe, on the other hand, there is only one country that shows growth of that period, which is the Netherlands within the EU zone. So Europe has a bit of a problem. The US continues to grow, though, around 1%.
Meanwhile, is the sharp rise in March U.S. CPI prices compared to February a good sign or something to be concerned about?
We didn't see long-term inflation effects. There's a lot of kind of buzz about long-term inflation effects or medium-term inflation effects in the U.S., but our view is that this is two factors. One is the base effect, meaning we saw so much disinflation or deflation in 2020 that we're seeing a base effect on that. The other one is supply constraints. So we're seeing holdback in supply chains, or we're seeing supply chains catch up from closure. So, pardon me, there is a constrained supply, which is driving up prices. As supply chains continue to equalize and balance out, we should see those prices return to normal. If we go back to the IMF forecast, we don't necessarily see rousing growth for 2021 compared to, say, 2019. So we have the installed manufacturing capacity in place. So I don't necessarily see demand outstripping supply to create the inflation that many people are talking about.
When do you expect the situation may look more normal, or when the situation would normalize?
It really all depends on when countries open up and that sort of thing. I would Q3 of 21 is when we start to see things more normal. I think it'll work out in between now and then. Of course, currency dynamics have a lot to do with that, but we'll have to see what happens with the dollar, with CNY and the euro to really understand how that will shake out. But we think we'll see normalization in, say, Q3.
Tony, the big Wall Street banks have kicked off earnings season with numbers out from JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs and Wells Fargo. They all beat estimates. But are these numbers sustainable or just a one-off blip following what was really a tough year?
Yeah, you know, they both did really well in terms of return on equity. And that's really one of the major requirements for banks. The real question is around loans. So we saw a spike in loans in the middle of 2020 in the U.S., largely on the back of, you know, small business owning and very low interest rates and government programs to push loans out. Loans are down in Q1 of 21. There is an expectation that loans will perk up again in the second half of 21. I'm not quite convinced we'll see the loan growth that was talked about today with JP Morgan's call I think we'll see tepid loan growth in the second half of 21, but I'm not necessarily sure that we'll see the spike that was discussed on the call.
So, Tony, legacy car brands and IT companies are both rushing into the electric vehicle space. Out of these two, who's likely to come out in front?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. You know, car brands make really good hardware, but they're really not great software makers. So I think there's going to be a combination of the car brands relying on battery makers and relying on software to make great electric vehicles. Excuse me, there are a lot fewer parts in EVs. And so these supply chains that the car manufacturers had to have for internal combustion engines change pretty dramatically for EVs. They're going to have to rely on, like I said, battery makers and software makers. I think the real question for the auto manufacturers is, what is that business model going forward? So software makers, and I think they may learn from software makers with the recurring revenue model. So we may take a car and pay a monthly charge for that car, almost like combining finance and the car itself. So car makers have a recurring revenue model with regular upgrades, similar to the way maybe some mobile phone carriers operate, those sorts of things. I think it's a stretch to have the one-time payment. I think car makers see that finance revenue go to other people, and they may want to do that themselves with EV.
Tony, out of curiosity, do you have any thoughts on what will define whether a legacy car brand is going to succeed in the new car world? Because a lot of them have been hesitant to move. They're going to have to make partnerships with battery makers. They're going to have to make partnerships with software makers. Are these going to be the two defining parts, who they partner on the battery and the software line?
Yeah, I think it depends on it. You know, the first mover is not necessarily the winner. So I think Tesla, ultimately, they're a great company. They make fine cars. Like every car company, they have problems, but I think they're fine. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be the winner. I think with Volkswagen announcing, you know, big moves in the market a couple weeks ago, if Toyota really goes, I mean, of course they're going after it already, but if there are real moves in that direction, I think the very, very large scale car makers will ultimately win. A lot of this has to do with regulatory and subsidy regimes within the consumption countries. So it is more expensive to buy an electric car. There is not the infrastructure necessarily to have electric cars to drive long distances, these sorts of things. So the subsidies that national governments put out to push that market forward are going to have a major impact on the adoption of those cars. The real danger, I think, is it's going to take a long time to roll out that infrastructure and other things. So the real danger for the guys who invest in EVs in a big way is a different type of technological change that could come around. I don't know what that could be. It could be a more efficient internal combustion engine. It could be, you know, I don't know, a different type of fuel or something that's a lot cheaper and a lot easier to use. So so there are a lot of question marks around the rise of EVs. I don't necessarily think that it's guaranteed that EVs will take over and that the big car companies are going to go 100% to electric vehicles.
Tony, you noted scale, right? The large scale makers like Volkswagen, Toyota, they've got essentially a conglomerate of other brands within them. Do you expect to see more consolidation, especially as this, because the car industry hasn't been doing that great over the last few years, and we've seen more M&As. Should we expect more consolidation, especially after last year?
I don't know. I don't know how much more there is to consolidate. I think you may get specialized boutique. You know, when you have technology changes in an industry, you always have specialized boutique companies that come around. We saw this in mobile phones, say 10 or 15 years ago, and those ended up being purchased. So I think we'll have an era where we'll have even more, say, boutique EV companies, small ones, that end up being bought by the larger guys. So, you know, a technological change really pulls along innovation. Big companies are really not good at innovation, so they typically have to acquire it. Will a Tesla be acquired? Probably not, at least not at this valuation. But other small companies, early stages, could potentially, if they have very good tech. So I think that's the way they leapfrog. I don't think it's the massive processes that they have internally, like a Volkswagen today, I don't think that's the way they leapfrog.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Tony. That was Tony Nash, CEO of Complete Intelligence, giving us some insight into what's happening in global markets.
So while talking about cars, very quickly, I see this headline here that Geely's Lotus Cars mulls raising 4 billion ringgit, and they're apparently doing this to help the iconic British sports and racing automobile brand to expand into the EV market in China, according to people familiar with the matter. And this is a story from Bloomberg. So Geely is working with advisors to sound up potential investors interested in funding the round. And that could see that could value Lotus EV operations at about $5 billion. This is going to be interesting because Lotus, of course, was formerly is part of the Proton Group, which was then bought by Geely.
Yes, so we're going to be heading into some messages now. And then up next, taking a look at MRT3's financing with financial columnist Pankaj Kumar. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.